Welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly roundup of what's been happening in Ukraine, focusing on a main story. I'm Marko Suprin for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week. There are three parts to Ukraine's economy: black, gray, and white. In the battle to turn Ukraine's economy white, the National Agency on Corruption Prevention created a new electronic declaration system, and the mandate is that anyone in government has to complete an online form and declare their wealth, and the favorites seem to have been cash, paintings, yachts, and watches. This week, the equivalent of $465 million in cash was declared by members of parliament, while $7 million was listed in the e-declarations of 24 ministers. Channel 24 estimated that the pile of cash declared by the parliamentarians alone must weigh around 27.5 tons, and if it was stacked up, it would be nearly 2,500 meters high. This would make it Ukraine's highest mountain, surpassing Mount Hoverla by about 400 meters. Now, the Minister of Justice admitted that he has $500,000 in cash, not in the bank. Now, before we start thinking about a Jacobin club or looking for a Robespierre-like approach to money and politics, and really, the piles of cash had Ukrainians wondering about the success of anti-corruption reforms because the scale is so huge. But almost everyone in Ukraine keeps dollars in their homes. Remember that 25 years ago, Ukrainians saw their savings in rubles turn to dust. Then, when the financial crisis hit in 2008, Ukrainians lost their savings again. After Russia's invasion and occupation, the hryvnia is suffering against the dollar, so most Ukrainians keep their dollars at home. What this does show is that there is very little trust in Ukraine's banking system, and the economy, therefore, stays gray. Some members of parliament poked fun at the system. Serhiy Melnichuk, former commander of the Aidar battalion, declared 3 trillion hryvnia in cash, and Oleg Lyashko, head of the Radical Party, declared his iconic pitchfork alongside luxury watches. Ukraine's prosecutor general, Yuri Lutsenko, promised to investigate the sources of income of every civil servant having over $100,000 in cash and will compare this amount to their previous declarations and check if all the taxes were paid. The European Union is apparently hedging its bet with regard to Ukraine. A vote in the EU Parliament about whether or not to create a visa-free regime between Ukraine and the EU has not been included in the draft agenda of the Parliament's next plenary session, scheduled for November 21st, which is the third anniversary of the Euromaidan protests. Ukraine has fulfilled its part of the bargain and has satisfied all 144 visa-free travel conditions, but the EU is reluctant to start the visa-free regime before the mechanism for the suspension is in place. According to Radio Liberty correspondent Richard Jozwiak, corruption in Ukraine and France are the main obstacles. However, Deputy Foreign Minister of Ukraine Olena Zerkal said in an interview on Channel 5 that the visa-free regime vote can still be added to the agenda on November 21st, provided that the EU countries agree on the suspension mechanism on November 7th. We'll be watching that story. President of Ukraine Petro Poroshenko had a telephone conversation with the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, and leader of the People's Party for Freedom and Democracy. Rutte assured Poroshenko that the Netherlands will not block the ratification of the EU association agreement between Ukraine and the EU, and instead will continue consulting, quote-unquote. Now, remember that the Netherlands held a referendum in which the people voted no to the EU-Ukraine association back in April. Many analysts back then noted that Russian disinformation in the referendum, something we'll talk about later in the show, was to blame for the outcome. Last week, Pavlo Klimkin, Ukraine's foreign minister, traveled to Holland to meet with Dutch leaders and convince them why it is important for Ukraine and the EU to move forward. Ukraine Calling listeners will remember that the Ukraine-EU association agreement was the trigger for the Euromaidan protests back in 2013. When then-President Yanukovych pulled out of the talks, people took to the streets. President Poroshenko also had two intense conversations with the president of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz, and president of the European Council, Donald Tusk. All of them agreed to coordinate their efforts to ensure the association agreement gets ratified. On November 2nd, 2 Ukrainian soldiers died in battle and 5 were wounded. The town of Stanitsy Luhansk remains under fire, while battles in the town of Avdiivka account for over 80% of the attacks by the Russian occupation proxies this week. Colonel Lysenko noted that every incident involved mortar shelling. the Russian occupation army and their proxies are directing their fire in the direction of the town of Mariupol. A spokesperson for the ATO said, quote, in addition to grenades and mortars, the occupiers are using armored personnel carriers and snipers. Lysenko also added that Ukrainian positions recorded two flybys of drones from the Russian-occupied territories. Hromadske Radio reported that as a result of the heavy fire in the direction of Mariupol, several villages suffered serious damage, leaving 600 buildings without gas. As of November 2nd, there are no mobilized draftees on the front. President Poroshenko met with Minister of Defense Stepan Poltorak and head of the General Staff of the Ukrainian Armed Services, Viktor Muzhenko, in which they announced that only members of the armed services who have signed contracts are now stationed on the front. He said, quote, Ukraine's armed services have to be made up of volunteers, soldiers who volunteer for service and assign a contract. They have to be properly motivated, prepared, trained, and outfitted. He also noted that a reserve made up of the demobilized will be created and should constitute about 100,000 servicemen. Defense Minister Poltorak said that there is no need for a seventh round of mobilization, and more than 50,000 have signed contracts who are currently undergoing training at various bases around Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia is restoring Soviet military bases in the occupied Crimean Peninsula. A Reuters reporter has seen 18 such restored military bases during his visit to Crimea, including airports for fighter jets and bunkers built during the Cold War. Another vector of Russian military activity was noted by the coordinator of the information resistance group Dmytro Tymchuk, who reported on his Facebook page that numerous military units and troops without identification have arrived in the Russian Rostov Oblast next to Ukraine's border on November 1. The SBU, Ukraine Security Service, uncovered a spy network in the Luhansk sector. Russian spies recruited a government employee of Ukraine's military civilian administration. Apparently, he agreed to work for them after his life was threatened. However, he was captured by counterintelligence agents of the SBU before he could leak any information. The SBU also announced that they are ready to exchange three Russian proxy prisoners for one Ukrainian. In a briefing in the city of Kramatorsk, Vasil Hrtsak, head of Ukraine's security service, said, quote, we've made our lists and we've given over the list to the other side in line with the terms and format outlined by Minsk. I'm hoping that priests will be able to help with this work so that we can hasten the return of our boys. But Irina Hiryashchenko, member of parliament representing Ukraine at the Trilateral Contact Group, says that the release of prisoners is still being blocked by the other side. They are demanding that 600 criminals be granted amnesty and have rejected the all-for-all exchange. Natalia Sharina, the director of a Ukrainian library in Moscow, goes on trial for storing Russophobic materials and loaning Ukrainian books. Books about the Holodomor, the genocide organized and executed by Stalin and the Soviet authorities in 1932-33 that took the lives of several millions of Ukrainians, were determined to be, quote, extremist and Russophobic, according to Russia's security service, the FSB. The librarian has been held under arrest for a year, but the first court hearing took place on November 2nd. UA Today reported that Human Rights Watch director in Europe and Central Asia, Hugh Williamson, called for the immediate release of the 58-year-old woman, saying that, quote, the detention of a librarian for the materials in her possession is not only an assault on her personal liberty, but on every person who cares about ideas and learning and education. The head of Ukraine's governmental public service broadcasting system, Zurab Alasanya, has resigned. Zurab Alasanya cited several reasons for his resignation, including the Soviet mindset of the employees and the burden to organize and fund the Eurovision contest, the responsibility for which was preliminarily assigned to the public broadcaster. The resignation of Alasanya, who has been leading the public broadcaster since its very beginning in 2014, is a cause for concern for Ukraine's journalists, activists, and representatives of parliament. They formed a coalition called For Public Broadcasting and even met with Prime Minister of Ukraine Volodymyr Groysman to ensure that the resignation of Alasanya will not lead to the failure of reforms in public service broadcasting. Hromadske radio correspondents Larissa Denisenko and Serhiy Sukhanov interviewed journalist Oleksiy Zakharchenko this week. Although he's a journalist, he was drafted into the army, and instead of putting his professional skills to use, he was stationed in an anti-aircraft unit. Being so close to the occupied territories, he noted that the propaganda being pushed by the Russian occupation administration is of a high quality. Oleksiy noted that there are more Russian stations than there were before the invasion happened. They managed to catch news TV stations like Novorossiya, Oplot, Oplot 2, First Republican, and others. He also said that there are no Ukrainian channels available. Oleksiy said, quote, "If you're unaware of the real situation and only watch the DNR news, you come to believe that everything is fine. Without skepticism, anyone will believe anything." But he also noted that there are plenty of people who are waiting for Ukraine to return. He was stationed at the zero block post that saw people coming and going from the occupied city of Donetsk, and many of the residents would ask, "Boys, when will you liberate us already? We're tired of waiting." For the past 3 years, if not longer, Russia has been running a disinformation campaign that reminds those of us who are old enough to remember about the lies that masqueraded as truth during the Soviet era. Orwell even wrote about the Ministry of Truth. Back then, however, the lies were easily identifiable. They came from government because the press was controlled by state security agencies, and it was easy to discern black from white. Today, that's not the case. Irina Chalupa is a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council and is a Fulbright scholar working on new media initiatives in Ukraine and was part of Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe back in the 1990s. Margot Hontar is a Ukrainian journalist and one of the founders at Stop Fake, an organization that has dedicated itself to exposing fake stories coming out of the Russian information space. Now, to tackle Russian disinformation, I think, requires ovaries of steel. Irina, Margot, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting.
Ovaries of steel?
Ovaries of steel.
I think it requires cojones of steel.
Cojones are also on the other gender side of the equation. Margot, what prompted you and the team at Kyiv Mohylen Journalism School to launch Stop Fake?
Well, the huge amount of disinformation, obviously, that was information space at March 2014. That's basically when we launched. And the willing to use our expertise and our skills to help people, basically, with the things we've done, like, the best for a long, long time. And I think this is also the result of this idea of having your own place and your own Maidan. I mean, the place where you are doing your job in the most perfect way.
Right, but you're a journalism major. You finished journalism school, but up until then you had a music career.
Yeah, I still kind
she
of
still
have
does.
It.
She still
thank you. I still kind of have it.
So what was the story that prompted you to react?
Well, first of all, the Maidan that prompted us to react, all of us. And secondly, the aggression, the green man in Crimea, because it was obviously the sign that everything got worse, and so we need to react, all of us. And the very fact that our director of Kyiv Mohyla School of Journalism, Yevgeny Fedchenko, made a call, basically, in Facebook group, like, let's meet and brainstorm and basically think what we can do, like, as a journalist. So I think that was just the perfect combo of just wanting to act.
Irina, you travel back and forth between the United States and Ukraine, and you've spent a lot of time launching media initiatives in Ukraine.
Actually, no, I haven't really launched any media initiatives in Ukraine.
Well, you've been working on radio in Kharkiv and Dnipro. These are some pertinent, I mean, these are initiatives.
These are student radio attempts, and they're not, I mean, it's very sort of initial level kind of thing. It's very basic.
Are the journalist students being trained with the skills to recognize these kinds of fake stories?
I think that most people in Ukraine almost instinctively recognize the Russian nonsense that is being fed to them. And in your introduction, you said that people of a certain age recognize disinformation and propaganda because we sort of grew up with it and it was generated by the then Soviet government. Well, it's still the same. It's still generated by the government. It's still done on a cross-national basis. It's still heavily supported financially and ideologically by the government. And now it's an alignment of perfect conditions, so to speak. The tools of the 21st century are such that they allow their lies and bullshit, I'm going to use that word, if I may, to be much more sexy. It's cloaked in the tools of the 21st century. You know, fact-checking is something that Stop Fake does and serious newspapers do and serious media organizations. Fact-checking is something that never existed in the Soviet mentality, and it certainly doesn't exist in the post-Soviet mentality. across borders. So they have it's a perfect situation for them to disseminate their lies. And also, in our time now is so kind of. People really consume information very, very quickly and don't stop to think about it. The 24-hour news cycle has changed the way we consume information, the way we process information, how we think about things. I mean, you've got several media outfits who are trying to propagate sort of the equivalent of slow foods, you know, the slow sort of media, the long reads and so forth and so on. Not everybody is even interested in that sort of journalism. We see it in the English-speaking world, but in this part of the world, it's here today, gone tomorrow.
You mentioned fact-checking. Margot, you attended the Poynter Global Fact-Checking Summit in London. And what were some of the conclusions that you walked away with from that summit?
Well, I've been to two of them, and I think the first conclusion is that the very fact which kind of fascinates me in a sad way, that there is actually a separate thing called fact checking. I mean, like, previously it was a part of journalist's job. I mean, like, that was what journalism was about, part of it. So you didn't need to differentiate whether you're a journalist or fact checker, but the very fact that there are like summits like this and the community of cessation of fact check is actually only growing, that only shows that the problem with journalism is so huge that you need a separate like group of people and even media outlets and even institutes that are actually focusing on fact checking.
Now, that's actually interesting because the media isn't only print. It includes pictures, videos.
Right, and social media, and as I love that, how Jessica Rowe, she's famous for researching trolls and how they behave from Finland. So basically, how she put it on a Finnish conference I've been also to in Helsinki, that basically what Kremlin is doing, they use social media as just general media, but just the new one. So basically, they also explore it and also speculate on it to later use social media to put it on just regular media outlets.
How many times have you guys noticed that the fake stories were being picked up by international media?
One story that got a lot of traction by all kinds of media that StopFake also was part of is the story of this alleged 13-year-old girl named Lisa
in
Berlin, who was, according to Russian media and Russian politicians, including Lavrov, she was allegedly kidnapped by some Arabs and sexually abused and raped over a period of 3 days and so forth and so on. And Russians in Berlin protested and accused the local authorities of not doing anything about it and so forth and so on. Well, the local authorities did investigate, and Lisa apparently, you know, just went off with her boyfriend and had a good time and then concocted a story. And there was no sexual abuse that had taken place. But these things take on a life of their own. And once it became part of the Russian public discourse, it just gained traction and kept growing. And the German authorities, including politicians and editors and journalists, you know, kept writing about it. And eventually it did sort of fade away. But this is an example of how lies can become real, you know, and it's sort of like in cartoons when you see a little snowball on top of a mountain and suddenly it becomes this huge monstrous ball that takes everything in its path. And that's the way these things work. I mean, this thing had a life that lasted about 2 or 3 months, right, Margot?
Right. And I think the most scaring part is that how later fakes work, that this becomes kind of myth with no actual name to the girl, just some girl being raped or abused. So and later the next stories can just, you know, be put up on this basement because people basically may not remember the details, but they remember the kind of story something happened. And this is basically why people can pick up the untrue stories.
Now, I remember that story that was pushed back in 2014, I think, about a child in the Donbass that was
crucified.
I think this is just like the classics. I mean, everyone kind of knows about it. This is just the basic stuff.
But shortly thereafter, there appeared the clip or the pictures of the woman who was a pro-Ukrainian dissident in the Donbass that was tied to a post and she was abused. Now, that was a real story. Right. So what happens in your opinion, we'll go with Margot first, when a lie brushes up against something that's true, what happens to the true story?
What happens to the true story? Well, I really love what Peter Pomerantsev says about this, about us being living in a post-fact era and the post-truth era. And basically, what happens is that they coexist because truth does not squeeze out the lies. And this is basically the problem. Even though we have all these stories published, they are not taken down by most of the media outlets. Maybe few of them taking it down or change, but this is just doesn't count in course of our 2.5 history years of history. So this is the problem, because to many of people, I think that means that it's not exactly understandable what is true and what is not, because they didn't take it down.
And how does that impact the United States? I mean, you see almost the genetic code behind a lot of these fakes, and you actually see it happening. It's having an impact on the U.S. elections.
Well, to some extent, but I'd like to just touch base on what Margot said. That story, Irina Dovhan is the woman who was tied to a post and abused and kicked by some really vile people in Donetsk. And her story would probably not have been noticed had a New York Times photographer not snapped a picture of it and written about it. And that story did feature in several prominent media, but it kind of fizzled away relatively quickly. She left the region and is now living here in safety, continuing her activist work. You know, it's almost being bad is sexier than being good. Lies and nonsense and fakes are sexier than truth more often than not. I don't want to really believe that, and I don't on some level, but the packaging that we have today makes these lies very, very palatable. And, you know, we recently debunked a fake that had been debunked in America already about ballot stuffing. You know, we have seen the American candidate, Donald Trump, generate all kinds of fakes by himself, calling into question everything from the American electoral system to how votes are cast to the very sort of framework of democracy. And a man who goes into an election and says it's all rigged is already dealing with very, very serious fakes. And so a very questionable a newspaper site actually called Christian Times newspaper or something like that ran up a story that with a photograph of a man unloading boxes and claiming that this electrician somewhere in Ohio while checking things in a warehouse stumbled upon, you know, tens and tens and tens of boxes of already ballots cast for Hillary Clinton. Well, this was complete and utter nonsense. It was a photograph that had been taken from Birmingham from 2015 when the UK was having a general election. They photoshopped ballot box out of the picture and, you know, they just made a fake about it. And Scopes is a debunking site, and so they sort of set the record straight and so forth and so on. But these things have a way of sort of perpetuating themselves. The internet is a free-for-all. It has no fact-checking, okay? Newspapers have editors. They have firewalls. Very few sites on the internet, unless they're the sites of responsible journalist outfits like the New York Times, Frankfurt Allgemeine, and so forth and so on. A lot of these things have no borders. You know, nobody controls them. The internet is still a relatively new thing. You know, we're dealing with copyright laws on the internet, editing rights, you know, slander, all of these kinds of things. So this is still a work in progress. And I think we're going to see this sort of gray area where lies become semi-facts, you know, facts are called into question, truth becomes an elastic concept. But we, those old-fashioned people who still believe in the truth, we just have to be doubly vigilant. And one of the things that I always say anytime I'm involved in a discussion, journalism is about truth. It is about truth. It's about covering the facts. Those basic questions that we ask, who, what, when, where, and so forth, these things have concrete answers. Journalism has room for opinion. It has room for commentary. But at the base of it all are facts. And facts are facts. They're hard. Black is black. It's not dark gray. It's black.
Is that being developed? Is that growing in Ukraine, that kind of real investigative journalism?
There are a lot of things happening in Ukraine in terms of that kind of digging. I think some of them are quite good. Others are less good. I mean, a lot of the kind of so-called investigative journalism is what people here call zliv. Somebody gives you.
Oh, right.
Somebody gives you documents.
Yeah, like Ukrainska Pravda resources.
Somebody who wants to, you know, screw somebody else, finds a journalist and gives him incriminating evidence about someone else. But we do see things, you know. We've got Nashi Hiroshi, who does some serious kind of stuff. But basically, it's sort of, we find Scam also, the Radio Liberty Project, is quite impressive. But basically, a lot of these things, most of the investigative work that is done here is about corruption and
right.
the enrichment of politicians. So basically,
which is an international phenomenon,
yeah.
mind
yes.
you. But
yes.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
we're facing an oligarch of our own,
yeah.
potentially.
Yeah, but I don't know. You know, I really don't know if we have these kinds of traditions here in Ukraine of editorial support, sort of collaboration of resources and efforts to really uncover these kinds of things. Like, for example, we know that there's a lot of corruption happening with the war, that a lot of people are making money on, you know, basically on blood and on the lives of Ukrainian young men who are dying at the front, and you know, through contraband and so forth and so on. So we hear bits and pieces of it, but I have yet to see something very, very kind of fundamental and concrete. There's a lot of supposition, a lot of suggestion, and we sort of understand that yes, everything's corrupt, everybody's corrupt, so there's bound to be corruption going on.
Are there outlets that are following the Russian disinformation model, but in a Ukrainian way?
Well, certainly there is. I mean, there are even. And we also are being part of this mutual project with our Eastern European colleagues. And basically, my job is to check Ukrainian media on how they are influenced by Kremlin propaganda. So there is such cases, just that So 4 months as we're actually doing this. Not sure about the future thing. I suppose we might, and also they are also included every time we spot them while doing our day-to-day job. So basically, I'd say we are doing this from the very beginning. It's just that Russian media, in a way, and foreign media spreading Russian point of view on Ukraine are the most dangerous things by our opinion. So I think this is why we're kind of focusing on it at the moment more.
There's we do a fair amount of debunking of Ukrainian lies as well. But basically, they're not generally lies that are generated in the Ukrainian media. They usually pick
right.
up something that's already existing on a Russian site or a Russian newspaper, and they go with that. So basically, it's copying, you know, copy-pasting kind of stuff. It's careless journalism. And when you look at just how people write news here, it's all the same thing. Nobody bothers rewriting, checking, or doing anything in terms of tailoring a news item to anything. So basically, there is that. I suppose, you know, a fact-checking exercise, enterprise, in today's day and age, I think is probably necessary in every Western
right,
country.
Right, this is like GGN. I mean, like, but in a way, because some Ukrainian outlets really pick up what Russian media outlets saying. Basically, when you stop, like, or fact check what Russian media is saying, you basically stop this food line because
yes.
Ukrainian media might not pick it up. And other things which we can see, like fake stories in Ukrainian media that might be just sloppy journalism, which might be not pick up from Russian media, but might be something from social or somewhere. But then we might deal with this as well, right?
Well, the battle is huge, and I'm convinced that the ovaries of steel are capable of the fight.
I object to that term.
Irina, Margo, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
This week, Ukraine's social media exploded with criticism of a sexist book that's supposed to be used by schools teaching a course on family values for teenagers. The book suggests that women should primarily devote their lives to their families and spend their time taking care of their beauty and developing feminine skills, such as cooking or painting. If a woman wants, she can also work, provided that this is a creative job helping her to reveal her femininity, the book says. Ukraine's Minister of Education, Lilia Hrinevich, explained that the Family Values course was aimed at reducing divorce levels in Ukraine and claimed that she finds gender inequality rhetoric unacceptable. She blamed this incident on the current system in which school books are being approved by volunteers instead of by a full-time paid committee of professionals. Another film being released this month is by director Alexander Alyoshkin and producer Alexey Kashin. The thriller is called Jungle, and the film's budget was around $220,000. Hromadske radio correspondent Irina Sampan interviewed the director and producer about their film. It's a thriller about people who find themselves in an abandoned village to, of course, repair their car. Getting in isn't always as easy as getting out, and in order to leave the village, the characters have to pay a price to the local sorcerer, and the price gets too big to pay when the wizard falls for the father's daughter. Film and music buffs got their fair share of both this past week. The 46th International Film Festival, called Molodist, was held in Kyiv from October 22nd through the 30th. The event grew from a modest start. In 1970, the Kyiv State Theatrical Art Institute organized a two-day showing of student films. Molodist means youth, and the festival's aim was to promote young professional cinema. Today, it's one of the main European film festivals and is ranked by the International Federation of Film Producers Associations. This year's festival presented around 250 films by young filmmakers from 80 countries. The Grand Prix winner was the film The Last Family by Jan Matuszynski from Poland. The prize comes with $10,000. We'll post a link to the festival website that lists all the films and winners on our page. On the musical front, Jamala, the Crimean Tatar singer who won the Eurovision contest, hit the headlines with a new recording. She was jamming with the cult group Dacha Bracha, and at the end of it, a new song appeared. They called it Zamanile, which means enticed, and released it on October 31st. Jamala described it as a sort of mystic folk sound. Have a listen and decide for yourself.
Не треба кричати.
Next week, Americans go to the polls to select a new president. Ukrainians are, of course, very interested to find out how U.S. foreign policy will change toward Ukraine, as well as what the next president will do with regard to Russia. We'll be following this and other stories. Tune in next weekend for a new episode of Ukraine Calling. If you have any suggestions or comments, feel free to write the show at ukrainecalling@hromadskaradio.org. I'm Marco Supran in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.